This is Alaskan Legislative Review, a program of analysis and discussion of issues facing the Alaska State Legislature, featuring the faculty and staff of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Tonight, Alaskan Legislative Review will focus on social services. Our guest is Patty Kastelic, who is the Assistant Director of the Women's Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Welcome to the show, Patty.
Hello.
We've seen and read quite a bit lately about social services as the budget for the Department of Health and Social Services has come before the legislature. Given that social services is such a large part of the state government's operating budget, and those kinds of services affect so many different people in so many ways, I'd like to ask you to give us some perspective on social services and perhaps a little bit of history, telling us how is it that government has gotten to be involved in these kinds of services? Where did it all start?
I'd be glad to, Scott. Historically, and now I'm going back a lot of years, 400 or so, we relied on mutual aid, voluntary assistance by extended families, by the community, and by the church. But as far back as Elizabethan England, when, with the coming of the Industrial Age, with increased mobility and more centralized government, government started to play a stronger role in the lives of citizens, and that included social welfare. The Elizabethan Poor Law that was passed in 1601 was intended mostly to control the poor, but in fact it provided two things that we still have very much in our social welfare policy at the present time. It institutionalized care for the poor in almshouses and workhouses. And it also established a means test, which is fairly unique for government funding. In other words, we established, the Elizabethans established at that time, a criteria for those that deserved government assistance, the so-called deserving poor, which were orphans or disabled, and the so-called undeserving poor, which were considered to be poor by virtue of their poor character. They were lazy or drunkards or syphilis. And we, in fact, still apply a means test, the deserving poor versus the undeserving poor.
Where do we make those distinctions? Do we make those in our statutes by saying, is this where the whole thing of how you qualify for something like food stamps comes in?
We make them when we set eligibility requirements. And also when we design the programs, which you'll see a little later. Many aspects of the English law held when the colonies were established in the United States, and particularly residency requirements. There was a fear even at that time that communities would have to support transients who would arrive in the community, and they did not want to do that. So very early on, residency requirements were incorporated, and in fact, we're still fighting that particular fight. You know, are we responsible for people that just arrive in Alaska and find themselves without resources? Are we supposed to take care of them? Anyway, in 1929, after the stock market crash in the United States, social welfare became a real issue. In the middle of the Depression, one out of four U.S. citizens was unemployed, and one out of every six was on welfare. And so we adopted this American thought that we would try anything, and if it didn't work, we would scrap it later, but just something to get the economy going and to help alleviate some of the distress that was being felt. Out of that Depression legislation came the 1935 Social Security Act, the Age of Dependent Children legislation, unemployment compensation, public housing, vocational education, rehabilitation, aid to the elderly. All of these were new programs coming out of the Depression, and most of them are still with us in one form or the other.
Patty, might I ask, those programs were largely New Deal programs from the federal government. What kind of programs and social services had state and local governments provided before the New Deal?
Actually, the state and local governments had the major burden prior to the Depression In 1890, the state and local governments were paying twice as much in social welfare support as was the federal government. Now, in 1980, the federal government pays four times as much as any state or local funds provide. So we've done a real gradual switching of roles, and that's partly because some of the states, it was perceived by the federal government, were not doing their job, and so they took increasing responsibility for that. Since 1935, we've tried to develop a rational public welfare system, and the rational process, this is a way of background to explain how this policy sort of evolved, requires that we actually could identify social problems and agree that there would be consensus that, these problems needed a resolution. We would have to agree on the values of our society and decide which ones are most important to us as a whole. And we would have to know the consequences of any plan so we could weigh the costs against the benefits of, that plan. And if, all of those things existed, then we could rationally decide how to approach social welfare policy. Actually, if the government is, going to do this, and that's who has taken on the responsibility, we have acknowledged that government must address problems that individuals are incapable of dealing with on an individual basis. Politics enters. A lot of people say that politics is the study of who gets what, when, and how. And so the kind of rational approach to policymaking sort of goes out of the window. We aren't capable of deciding as a whole what social values are. There's much disagreement on that. If we can't agree what the problems are, it's difficult to decide how to address them. It's difficult to predict the consequences of any plan or action. It's very difficult for us as a society to weigh costs. How do you weigh the cost of human dignity against raising taxes, for example? So that's a little difficult to factor in. And when we get politics involved, we're not necessarily motivated by social values. We are also factoring in power and money and an ability to be reelected. And historically, the poor and the sick and the disabled have really less representation in government than those with property and with money and with vested interests that contribute to campaigns and so on.
How is it that there's a strong argument, or an often heard argument, made by people who claim that the government is spending too much money on social welfare services, that says our values have been turned around too much, that we've gotten too far away from private, voluntary, and charitable agencies providing social welfare services as opposed to the government? Where does that fit in historically?
Well, actually, at the time of the San Francisco earthquake, when Coolidge was president, we had no disaster relief. And so at that point, it was completely in the private sector. Hoover was famous for his remarks about how people should help themselves, pull them up by their bootstraps. And we seem to be going a little bit back to that. I think most of the cost comes in because bureaucracy is, in fact, very unwieldy. And because it's not possible for us to invoke policy through purely rational means, we do it incrementally. And it's very hard for the bureaucracy to respond. So once we have a program which is implemented, we either can increase the budget allocations or we can decrease them. But we generally leave them in place even when they're not effective programs. And it's hard to coordinate individuals, groups, experts, agencies, politicians, and get them all together at the moment of decision-making. And so I think that really accounts for a lot of what the public perceives as excess expense, because it's very hard for us to say, okay, this program's no good. We're just going to get rid of it altogether.
What do you know about how the public feels about government providing social welfare services today? Are there some facts or figures?
There are continuing polls, and it's a very mixed thing. We'll go back to the Elizabethan definition of the deserving poor versus the undeserving poor. Most Americans feel that it is an obligation of government to provide for those that truly can't provide for themselves. But they also would like to, there is also accompanying that what seems to be a contradictory opinion, that there's too much governmental support of people who are shiftless and lazy, and they are trying to take advantage of the social welfare programs. And I think we should add here that social welfare includes an entire range of programs, that it includes workman's compensation and social security and health programs. It isn't just actual checks to families that are at poverty level. Some of them are hidden and are obvious. Some of them are hidden and some of them are very obvious, but it's all a part of our social welfare program.
Well, okay, I was going to ask you to continue along with that and say there are contradictions in the way the American population looks at social services and their delivery. How is that reflected in the federal government today?
Well, we are looking at a major change if the Reagan administration's policies are in fact implemented and carried out. The Reagan administration would like to see many of the programs that have been taken over by the federal government in the last 20 years since the 1960s return to the states through the help of block grants. And he says that the federal government will continue to aid the truly needy, here we go, that phrase again, with a social safety net of programs which will include, on the federal level still now, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment compensation, veterans benefits, supplemental security income, which is to the blind and the disabled, Head Start, summer jobs, and free school lunches. However, he wants to return to the state, the jurisdiction of the states, aid to the families of dependent children, food stamps, Medicaid, housing assistance, the CETA programs, social services, compensatory education, as well as legal services, which is a huge amount of responsibility that the states need to develop a plan for implementing, because he wants the states to determine the criteria and the amount of services rendered and the requirements. So that's going to be a lot more state responsibility, and we need to think about that carefully and not just continue this sort of incremental process.
So what's being proposed is not a total throwback to what it was before the Depression, where the state and local government bear the entire burden of providing these services and the federal government nothing. Rather, the Reagan administration is proposing to cut back a significant number of federal services, keep some, but deliver the bulk to the states.
They describe it as a jurisdictional thing, that it will be up to states, to the state's discretion, how much or in what form they want to continue those programs, and that they will be given in block grants federal aid, which in some ways represents the amount of funds they receive now, but consolidated and in most cases at least slightly reduced, and that the states will take over the administration of those projects and programs.
Doesn't this bring up the possibility of, as happened before, where the states won't fulfill their duties, where they might become too arbitrary, too cheap, too discriminatory in their services?
Well, I certainly think it will depend on what state you're living in. Some of them have reputations as having a lot of social responsibility, and there are some states that have evidenced themselves in the past to be fairly reactionary and to have a very rugged individualist, everyone can take every man, woman, and child for him, her, themselves attitude. I think that remains to be seen. There may be some general flocking to some more liberal or generous states by the poor, and we really haven't pulled out of this recession yet. Our needs are acute. We're also in the process of redefining some of the social problems. For example, we now define child abuse and domestic violence as provinces for the state, that those are unacceptable forms of behavior, and we have instituted some grants and some programs to address those community problems. So I suppose it'll depend very much on where you live.
With new definitions of acceptable behavior and unacceptable behavior, as we progress as a society, we hopefully discover there are more and more things that we used to regard as acceptable that we don't anymore. How is that reflected in changes in social services? As you said, we've assigned domestic violence and child abuse. We now regard that as unacceptable behavior. What kind of actions have states taken to address those problems?
Well, we have in Alaska a very complex web of social service deliveries. We have the institutionalized departments and divisions within those departments where the state has clearly acknowledged that this is an ongoing problem and that we need a service delivery to deal with it. For example, corrections. I mean, obviously, that's something individuals cannot handle. And there are many programs within social services that fall in this category. We also have, at the same time, and in and amongst the actual government divisions and departments, a whole network of nonprofit organizations which generally spring out of perceived community need. They can be started by groups or individuals that form a group to address a particular problem, and then they petition the state or the federal government or perhaps the municipality to receive funds to help solve this problem. And sometimes nonprofits are in fact an instance of the state contracting with a professional caregiver because the service can be delivered more efficiently, more cheaply, and the state perhaps sees that this will only be a temporary need by society, and so why institutionalize it and make an actual part of the bureaucracy? So you get all that combination of things. In Alaska, I guess we can go through some departments here. I'd like to say that so we don't get people all emotionally distracted, Americans do believe that there are some needy poor that deserve help. One of those groups is the elderly. The senior citizen population, which is those individuals we've arbitrarily decided over 65, has tripled in the last century. In 1935, when the Social Security Act was passed, less than 3% of our population was over 65, and now 11% is. In fact, I discovered a startling fact that there are more adults turning 75 in the United States on a yearly basis than there are children being born. So obviously, we've got a real elderly population. We also have a lot of a distressingly increasing disparity because of single women heading families, becoming heads of household. And for a variety of reasons, they more and more of them are being defined as in the poverty class. And many of those women have not traditionally been poor, but through lack of job opportunity and lack of good child care or inability to pay for child care and lower wages than men make, they find themselves thrust in the poverty class. So we have a lot of departments and divisions within our state agencies that address both the elderly and women with children who are supporting those children and themselves. For example, let's take the Department of Health and Social Services. Their stated goal is, quote, to improve and maintain physical, emotional, social, economic well-being of Alaskans so each individual is as self-sufficient as possible. That's quite an undertaking, wouldn't you say? Anyway, to address that, within that department, we have the Division of Family and Youth Services, and it's their job to prevent and remedy child abuse. We have, Aid to Families with Dependent Children is in that. The Old Age Assistance Program is within the Department of Health and Social Services, and they also contract to, in Fairbanks, for example, the Resource Center for Parents and Children. That's the Department of Health and Social Services, but we also have the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and they render assistance to the community and regional level, and they're responsible for housing assistance and for senior citizens housing and for employment opportunity, which includes child care assistance, and for training programs, and they administer the Displaced Homemakers Program, which is their financing of that program has recently received quite a bit of publicity and is somehow in doubt. Maybe we could use that as a quick example. The governor's budget proposed that displaced homemakers be funded at $630,000. The House Finance Committee reduced that funding level somewhat and passed on it at $585,000. The Senate Finance Committee, based on the recommendation of the subcommittee, canceled out that budget altogether, gave no appropriations to the displaced homemakers funding because they said that it was a duplication of services offered somewhere else within the government. In some communities, I think that's true. In Fairbanks, the displaced homemakers program here does not offer a duplication of services. So now that budget will be decided on in three conference committee, where they will have to choose between the House finance recommendation of $585,000, the Senate version, which is zero, or perhaps something in between. And obviously, we have to make hard choices about where we're going to spend our money.
Patty, I'd like to go back to the Department of Health and Social Services. This represents the state's largest department that has institutionalized the delivery of social welfare services.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, is there any thought being given to how much of an increase will have to take place in the delivery of these services when and if the federal transfer occurs? Is the Department of Health and Social Services going to be the agency where, if the federal transfer takes place, is that where most of the money will go to administer those programs?
Well, from the list I read, it would appear that the Department of Health and Social Services is the department that's primarily responsible for those programs that Reagan's talking about passing over. But we already are looking at restricted funding for those programs. Fairbanks, for example, has had no new social workers in 7 years, no new social work positions, and the caseload has doubled. Even if the block grant switch is made, we're going to look at even more reduced funding. And when you couple that with reduced revenues on the state level, we are going to either have to withhold some services that are presently being offered, and given our crime statistics and our need statistics, we're already severely overloading those services. Or we're going to have to spread them a little thinner and reduce the amount of aid given each individual. But there are definitely hard choices to be made. And, of course, we're going to have to choose between that part of the budget, which is called operating budget, which are the service aspects of government, and capital projects. And there's, of course, great lobbying effort made to government to spend money on the capital projects. And these are choices that citizens are going to have to decide.
Okay, what other agencies does the state have that are, institutional delivery of services?
Well, they're all interrelated, in fact. Department of Revenue is responsible for the Child Support Enforcement Division, which collects court-awarded alimony payments, which the custodial parent is unable to collect. And my understanding is that in Alaska, there's $21 million of uncollected child support payments floating around out there. And it's an apparently understaffed agency. Hopefully, by the time the budgetary process is completed in Juneau, they will have full staff, because this is a cost to the state. Parents, custodial parents that don't receive child support are forced very often to rely on aid to families with dependent children, to rely on health, state-supported health care, general relief, medical, and so on. So obviously, what the Department of Revenue fails to collect is a cost to the state that they pay out to other agencies. The Department of Public Safety is responsible for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is the agency, or is the council, which gives grants and oversees a large network of nonprofit shelter organizations and counseling agencies within Fairbanks, Star Awake, and so on and so forth. And that's all within the Department of Public Safety. And Community Regional Affairs, to get back to that particular department, they also do senior citizen property tax exemption and senior citizen sewer and water deferment programs. So, you know, if you're elderly and if you can find your way through the bureaucracy, there's some help from a large variety of agencies, and there's some logical reasons why various programs may have been placed with either community regional affairs or with health and social services or with revenue, but it can make a very frustrating picture for the average citizen, and it can make communication and coordination difficult. And I don't think it's a plot on the part of anyone, but the sort of incremental way or the add-on way that we develop policy, as we discussed earlier.
Well, it appears that over the course of a few hundred years, social services have become more and more the responsibility of government. We saw a big jump with the federal government entering into the area during the Depression. We now find that the federal government would like to cut back on its commitment to social services and return it to the states. And in the case of Alaska, we find that we have a social service delivery network that it appears is being fully utilized, that there is a great demand for the services being offered. Now the question becomes a political one, one involving the budgetary process, and I would guess one involving how well represented are the consumers of these services? How well represented are poor people, women, the sick, the disabled?
Well, traditionally, they've been poorly represented. They don't contribute largely to campaigns. Very often, they don't even vote. So they rely on their funding largely from agencies, which are caregiving agencies, or from media attention. And so they have to trust that those lobbying efforts will be successful and rely to some extent on the conscience of our representative officials.
Which goes back to where the whole process of how we try to find agreement with each other over what our values should and could be.
Right.
Regarding these kinds of things.
It's hard to identify the problems, to agree on them, let alone to agree on the solutions. And I think progress has been made, and I think we need to make more progress.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Patty. Very interesting to hear from you, and I would hope to explore this issue at some depth. It seems there are quite a few people out there who this is literally a very important matter.
Well, we'll be watching with interest this budgetary process here. There's no clear statement of policy than the kind of allocations and appropriations that are made, so we'll be watching.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. Our guest tonight has been Patty Kastelic, Assistant Director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Women's Center. Our subject tonight has been social services and their future before the legislature. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. If you would like a cassette copy of tonight's program, please send $5 to KUAC FM, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.